Richardson stayed long, that he was going to either build 20, 15, or 12 homes with them. He built 12. He sold all 12. He settled up with Richardson Savings Loan, and he bowed out of the joint venture.
Mr. Cho, a moment ago, I want to be sure I understood you correctly. I think you made the statement that this court has never approved of the concept that a prediction can be actionable fraud. Was that your statement?
In the absence of the person making the, who made the prediction lying about it at the time he made it. Yes, sir. That's correct.
Wilson versus Jones, which was Commission of Appeals case, doesn't that stand for the proposition that expression of an expert opinion as to something in the future can be actionable?
The Wilson Jones case is an excellent case. In fact, I quote from it at length in my brief. And to the extent that we're talking about special category experts or fiduciary relationships or family relationships, then I stand corrected by the court. I'm going to allow myself to extract that statement, or at least modify it to the point where we're talking about in less than usual circumstances. If we've got a father-son, a prize fighter versus a commoner, expert versus a layman, yes, those are different things because they the gabbling of what the courts are trying to protect and the way they're trying to do it is different. We're trying to protect and keep people from overreaching. It's not just a question of lying or misrepresenting things to people. It's a question of overreaching. But when we're talking about the representation cases, whether he lied to me or he didn't, the Wilson case very succinctly points out the very declamation that I'm talking about between the two, that you've got to have, if you're going to talk about things in the future, you've got to have a culpable state of mind. And I started to do this a moment ago. Let me read this first two issues to the court. The way they're framed, you can see what the jury is doing if you look and read the issues. Do you find for preponderance of the evidence that prior to the purchase of Green Hollow lots by Oxford, that Raymond Ratcliffe made false representations, either one or more, to representatives of the plaintiffs as to material facts with the intent of inducing plaintiffs to purchase Green Hollow lots and which were relied upon by plaintiffs? The answer was, and he said, in answering above this, you must confine your deliberation to those representations, if any, regarding the removal of the trailer park, completion of the bridge on Alma Road, and construction of an elementary school. Well, in the old days, that would have been not a very good issue because it would have allowed the jury to speculate one part of the jury on one representation and another on another, but the cases seem to say now that this issue might be acceptable as to not be more fair. The second issue then says, if you've answered the first one, then answer the special issue number two, yes or no, otherwise do not. Do you find from preponderance of the evidence that the representations of Raymond F. Ratcliffe, if found by you in response to special issue number one, were? Now, the court had the issue divided into trailer park, bridge, and school. It said, one, known by Raymond F. Ratcliffe to be false when made. The jury said, no, he didn't know it was false as a trailer park. No, he didn't know about the bridge was false. And no, he didn't know about the school being false. Then he said, two, made recklessly, without any knowledge of the truth and as a positive assertion. It was at that point, Mr. Garland, that I objected to this issue on the grounds that under the evidence in the case, recklessly is not appropriate. Again, if you go to the rules here, you can't have a reckless misrepresentation about the happening of a future event. I mean, how do you do that? The law has been in this jurisdiction, I see a smile from the court, but the law in this jurisdiction has been simply that when you're talking about predictions, they're all reckless. And no reasonable person is entitled to place reliance to his detriment and damage upon a prediction. Now that's clear. And the cases I cite, extensive cases, including the Wilson case, on that point. So reckless has to deal with the question of present existing fact. In fact, in the Wilson case, that's where the term reckless first got into the jurisprudence of this state. But in that case, it also pointed out that that only deals with a case where you have your representation with regard to a present or past fact. If you recklessly represent something as having been true, whether you knew it or not, cases say now you don't have to prove that guy really didn't know it. But the cases also say that if he predicts what's going to happen in the future, recklessness is not an element. Because all people are required to understand under the law that a prediction is nothing more than a prediction, and you can't have a degree of recklessness involved in predictions. Who's to say one is more secure than the other? The government would be well off if we could categorize degrees of dependability of prediction. But that's the case law. But back to what was happening here with the jury. They were finding the word reckless. And then we go over to the only other issue, which was submitted by the plaintiff other than the damage issue, which was on the question of malice. So do you find these patients by Ratcliffe were made with malice? Malice, as used in this charge, means ill will, bad or evil motive, or such gross indifference to the rights of others as will amount to willful wanton act. I again objected on the grounds that gross indifference is not an element under the facts of our case, that in order to prove malice, they had to prove that it was their intent to induce. And that's clear under the cases too. In order to get a finding of malice, you do have to prove that the person intended with ill will and evil motive of mind to induce you and did so in order to find malice. So what the jury was allowed to do then, when you take this charge with the first issue lumped together, the second issue of reckless representation, and malice over here, gross indifference, the jury was allowed to speculate and say, well, if this rumor floating around out here in this neighborhood, the man Ratcliffe, who was selling these lots for Richardson's Day Malone, he should have known that.
Are you saying that in order to have actual fraud, that the statement must be made with actual knowledge of their fraud?
No, sir. I'm saying there's two kinds of fraud under the cases in this jurisdiction. One is fraud that deals with present or past facts and representations with regard thereto. As to that, you don't have to have knowledge of whether it was true or not. The cases say if you say it and it's wrong and somebody relied on it, we got you. That's misrepresentation cases. I'm saying with regard to the other type of cases in this jurisdiction, where you tell somebody that something's going to happen, or you promise, you know, there wasn't any common law action for this to begin with. It wasn't until we passed 4001 or 4, I guess it was, the old statute on sale and fraud and sale of real estate and stock. It wasn't until we got that statute or its predecessor that there was any common law action for prediction of future events or representation about what was going to happen, even if you made the promise that you were going to do it. So, as to those cases about what was going to happen in the future, all cases in this jurisdiction, as in most jurisdictions, say you got the man who said it had to know it was false at the time he did that. The two cases that the Tyler Court cited in their opinion when they sent this case back to be tried to allow Trenholm the opportunity to get in through a narrow window on common law fraud, they say that the only way that he can do that is to show, since this is a prediction, the only way he can do that is to show that Ratcliffe had special knowledge that he misrepresented. And he conveyed that impression and asserted that to Trenholm. The two cases are the industrial transportation case, Russell versus Industrial Transportation side in the brief, and the other one is the City of Houston, Howe versus the City of Houston. Those two cases The court goes at length in both the opinions of those cases to point out the type of special knowledge that's required in order to slip through this window to get in on these representations of future events. In the first case, we had some suede shoe stock salesmen went out to El Paso and got a hold of some rather unsophisticated farmers and were selling them a bunch of stock. And they told them that we know this company. We're officers of this company. We've been involved with this company. We know the financial condition of this company. We know that there's an active market in the trading of the stock of this company. And we know the owners. We know that it's going to show a profit. This company's going to show a profit. And we're telling you, on the basis of that knowledge, that the stock is going to triple its price in the next 20 days. The farmers bought it. They sued. The question was, and this is the 1923 case. The question at that time was, well, wait a minute, this is a prediction of what that stock's going to do, and that's really what hurt them was that's the reason they bid on this, was because they promised it was going to triple in value. Is that recoverable? The court says, yes, because the jury found that the salesman at the time they represented that they had all this knowledge lied, that they didn't really believe the stock was going to be triple in value when they said it.
Counsel, you've taken your time.
Thank you.
We'll hear reply from the petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Page, Keegan will argue the case at the bottom.
May it please the court. I should say at the outset that the petitioner agrees with very little of what the respondent has said about said fraud. Historically, in Texas, and everywhere, long before Article 4004 was passed, which is now Article 2701 of the Business and Commerce Code, an opinion could be just as actionable as a statement made in the form of a misrepresentation of fact, if it was made under circumstances where it would imply that the speaker who uttered the opinion had information to back it up that would justify a reasonable person in asserting that opinion. So that everywhere, predictions and opinions have been actionable when made under circumstances where those opinions or predictions imply information on the basis of which the opinion would be justified. Obviously, an opinion expressed in a set of circumstances where both parties are looked upon as being on an equal footing with respect to the information about which the opinion or prediction is expressed would not be actionable. People are not supposed to rely on the judgment of others. But when an opinion is made under circumstances which convey information, then under those circumstances, the opinion can be actionable. The truth of the matter is that there are three kinds of statements made and that induce transactions. One is the type of statement where the opinion or prediction is nothing but that. Pure judgment of the speaker based on information equally available to both parties. Second, the type of statement which is a pure representation of an existing fact. And the third type of statement that is an opinion or a prediction under circumstances where the person is describing information that he has that would justify the statement being made. Obviously, in this case, before the court today, Ratcliffe was expressing an opinion based on information that he was supposed to have regarding that trailer park. And the truth of the matter is, as Mr. Selby indicated to this court, he made misstatements of fact, just as surely as anyone can do. And those misstatements of fact were very important because they were the basis on which the opinion was justified. If the trailer park had already been sold, if the people had been given some kind of a notice, Then the opinion was justified, but it was not in this case. So that it seems reasonably clear to us that the opinion was, even if it was only an opinion, would be actionable, but the fact is that there were misrepresentations of fact made on which the jury were justified in finding fraud. Much was said about this agreement, and I think the joint venture agreement is important in this context because it was made in reliance on the representations made in the December meeting. Now, this was an agreement with the Savings Association. It was not an agreement to buy lots from the Savings Association. I don't know whether this agreement needs to be in writing under the statute of frauds. I doubt it. I know it was partly performed, and a lot of performance had been engaged in. There would have been many legal issues involved, and I am not as confident as respondent is about whether or not Mr. Prenholm was bound or not. I have a feeling he might very well have been bound at the time of discovery. Whether or not is not really very important, because he had all kinds of problems if he had dared to escape from the agreement that he'd made with the savings and loan, because that was not an agreement with the person that committed fraud. He was at liberty to do what he wished to do, so far as Ratcliffe was concerned in this case. But he had changed his position considerably by virtue of the joint venture agreement, and it seems to me he was perfectly free to go ahead and do the best he could in the light of the condition that he found himself in. Now, much was made of the finding that he didn't have knowledge of the falsity of this statement. Actually, the issue as framed, I could find fault with. I think the better way of framing this issue would have been, did he know of the falsity of this statement, or was it made recklessly, all in one issue? But it's perfectly clear to me, it seems, that if he realized in his own mind at the time this statement was made that he didn't have the kind of information that he ought to have to make the prediction that he was making, he made it recklessly. Actually, the finding on special issue number 2-2 that he made it recklessly is all that's necessary to justify punitive damages in this case. And the further issue on malice was unnecessary, although submitted as such. But as soon as the jury found that the opinion statement was made recklessly, there was a finding necessary sufficient to get punitive damages in this case. Let me say also that in the Tyler case involving Article 4004, the jury found fraud just as they did in this case. And in all frankness, it seems to me that case should have been affirmed. I see no difference between the kind of statement that would be actionable under Article 4004 and the kind of statement that would be actionable under common law. The purpose of that statute was to eliminate the necessity for proving dishonesty as a basis for recovery. It was passed in order to get an innocent misrepresentation actionable. It was an opinion statement, but it was an opinion statement that was made that implied that there was information to back it up, and there was not. To back it up. Here, Prenholm made a statement that the property was sold when he either knew it hadn't been sold or he realized he had no information because the record is clear on that, that there was no evidence to support the position that he had any information.
You mean Ratcliffe, Reverend Trenholm?
Yes, sir. Yes, beg your pardon. I mean Ratcliffe, Reverend Trenholm. There was no information in the record. He had information of any kind to indicate that it had been so. So, if there are one other point, I think, as Mr. Shelby mentioned, it seems to us that the court should be that the court should reverse him and render or affirm the trial court's judgment, since no points were raised in the Court of Civil Appeals, and the only issues raised were issues of law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be submitted on brief and oral argument.